It is week 39 of the year 2021. It just stopped raining outside, and I skipped my run. That's why I'm here, recording this show for you. Welcome back to another episode of Father Roderick to the Max, the show that I record for you because you are one of my monthly supporters. And I am so happy that you help me to do what I love to do, and that is to record podcasts, create videos, and much, much more. I've got lots of things to talk about. Of course, there will be the usual segments. We'll talk a bit about health. I'll talk about vegan and vegetarian cooking, and what's the difference between a dog and a pig. I'll talk a little bit about the Book of Boba Fett, and what Pope Francis said about homilies is that they shouldn't last longer than 7 or 8 minutes. I'll give you my thoughts on that, and then I'll talk about a fantastic board game that I recently played with Eric, who is going to be a priest next year, and who lives here in the rectory with Father Henry and me. And I discovered he is a fellow board gamer, and it is so much fun to, after so much time in pandemic isolation, finally be able to play board games with a friend again. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. So thanks to you, I'm able to do this, and I hope you enjoy this show as a thank you in return. By the way, did I mention that I love this kind of music? I almost feel like dancing when I hear this tune. I'm so glad that I changed the old, very brief intro tune to this big band music, which kind of fits the style of the opening of my regular show, Father Roderick. So, I am supposed to be in my new home, my rectory, but you can't tell from the audio because this sounds the same, and it will sound the same in the future because of the equipment that I use, but I am still at the rectory in the loft. The reason being that despite the fact that we started the process of moving on the 1st of October as planned, there are still some hiccups that I did not foresee. The most important one being that the head of operations, the person who together with someone else has worked for 6 months now, and who was supposed to finish the work last week so that I could move in, has fallen off his bike and has broken his collarbone, which is a very, very painful injury. And it takes between 6 and 8 weeks to heal. You can't put it in a cast or anything, so he has to be very careful. Which means that none of the work that was planned for last week could take place. Well, not everything, because the electrician has finished his work. So I finally have all the lights in the kitchen, and I've got some really cool, how'd you call them? Spotlights in the ceiling of my studio upstairs. So that is very cool that is all finished. So I'm happy with that. And also in terms of when it comes to the radiators, so the heating system, that is not operational either because they have ordered the material. But since it's still COVID time and a lot of the factories have backlogs, a lot of the material's not yet there. So I may have to wait, I don't know, could be weeks. Hopefully not longer because it's really getting cold outside, but I'll have to wait a while before I really get the heating system. However, I am determined to move in. So what we did was last Saturday, we cleaned the upper floor of the rectory. As you can imagine, there's a lot of dust and, the house has been a shell for 6 months, and there's been so much work being done there. So all that has to be cleaned. We didn't even get to clean the ground level. And there's another reason for that. Since the kitchen is not ready, we can't really clean it yet. However, the upper floor is now, I think, mostly ready. So we've moved some of the IKEA furniture that I bought years and years and years ago. I discovered that most of the IKEA stuff that I have is no longer even in the catalog of IKEA. They change their inventory every year. And over time, some stuff is phased out, except for the billies, you know, the bookshelves. If you buy those, they will probably last for another century and you will always be able to buy some extra material. But for most of the other stuff that I have, it's no longer available, which means I have to be extra careful, because if I break something in the process of moving, then I won't be able to repair it anymore. There are no spare parts. So what we did is we moved some of the shelves, the bookshelves that I had on the ground level in my old rectory. We moved them to my work studio and created a nice wall. I kind of hesitated to move that furniture into the new house because the color is a little bit outdated. It doesn't really match the overall color scheme of the house that I chose for the house. So upstairs, mostly it's like a very light gray. It's a bit more modern. Also, the carpet is grayish. So at first I was like, maybe I should go for something lighter, something a little bit more updated. But then I thought, you know, I paid hundreds and hundreds of euros for all this stuff, and why would I get rid of it now if I don't have anything to replace it with? And added to that is also, I'm going to use that studio for many different purposes. Of course, to work and to do my editing, but also to film. And since I am doing quite a few reviews of movies and books and video games, I felt that I needed to have at least one place in my house where I can create a bit of a more of a geek atmosphere. And these four bookshelves are really useful for that, because I can put all my Star Wars and Harry Potter stuff in there and create a nice backdrop for you know, video streams and stuff about geeky themes. So we put it there, and actually it looks better than I thought it would. So it's not that bad. We're going to create one Lego room. So that's actually very simple. Those are actually guest rooms. They're very small. So you can barely fit in one bed and then maybe a chair. That's about it. So the house itself feels big, but the actual rooms are quite small. And so I think I'm just going to put one table there so I can do my Lego streams from there. There is even a special wired internet connection in that room because I knew that I was going to stream lots of Lego stuff there. And then the room next to that is going to be my bedroom. I'm still kind of figuring out how to put my bed. I'm following a bit the philosophy of Feng Shui, which is this kind of Chinese approach to where you place, for instance, your bed, your tables. And it has to do, it sounds a bit esoteric, but it's actually based on movement. It's how do you enter a room? And what do you want to feel when someone is entering the room? That's why in Feng Shui, for instance, you never want to sit with your back to the door, because it feels kind of uncomfortable. You never know if someone is going to sneak in. Now, of course, I live alone in that house, but still, it's kind of like we're almost programmed to always be aware that maybe an enemy can attack us from behind. I don't know how much of that is culturally based and how much of it is, I don't know, instinct. But I do know that since I started to apply those principles, it actually really made me rethink how I organize the furniture in my rooms. I'm following this guy on TikTok. I think he's called Modern Something, and he has all these cool little tutorials about the Feng Shui principles. But what he does really well is he has these if you want to look for the TikTok, and he's also on YouTube, it's called Dear Modern, like dear so-and-so, which you put in a letter, Dear Modern. He has these small models, and he shows you, for instance, a room, a tiny room, and he says, well, here's a bed, here's a chair, and here's... But how would you rearrange this if you would follow the principles of Feng Shui? And then he shows you an alternative disposition, and I've learned so much. Just having that sense of rethinking what you can do with a room and how a room feels, it has helped me tremendously thinking ahead of before I moved in, how I wanted my furniture to be placed and what kind of feeling I wanted to have in the different rooms. So for my sleeping room, the house was actually built with the idea that the bed would be behind the door opening, which is the worst part, the worst place. It's the only place where you would find such a setup is in retreat centers, where often the rooms are also small and the bed is like behind the door. So if you open the door, you have to kind of walk around the door to see your bed because it's so tiny. And of course, in terms of maximizing the space, it is the best place to put it, but it feels very uncomfortable. And so I'm putting the bed in a perpendicular fashion so that if you enter, you see the bed, the length of the bed. Now, that is still not perfect, but it's definitely the best feasible position for the bed. And then I'm going to put some bookshelves in the corner to make it a bit more cozy. Those rooms are very dark. The house has tiny windows. So, but for a place where you sleep, that doesn't really matter. For my studio, I wanted to have the lightest room because I love it when in the morning I sit in the sunlight. And so the big room on the upper floor is actually, even in the plans of the architect, was called the master bedroom. And was also called the bishop's room. So if the bishop would stay over, that's the room that his bed would be in. And all the previous owners have always put their bedroom in that room. And I was like, no, that's such a waste. That's the best room of the house in terms of light, in terms of the overall shape of the room. It's a rectangular room. It's very, very, you know, easy to use. So I was like, I knew immediately that's going to be the room where I put my desk, and that's the room where I'm going to have my little geek corner and where I have a large open space for my VR experiments. You know, I want to have at least one room where there's not much furniture that I can bump into when I'm wearing VR goggles. So that's that. And then on the front side, there is a smaller room, which I initially thought that would be a great bedroom, because it's small, and I'm a little bit like a hobbit. When I sleep, I feel more comfortable when I'm in a smaller room rather than a big room. But then the room is so small that I can't really put the bed in a good place. And if I put a bed in there, there's not much space left. At first I thought I'm just going to put it in, use the width of, it's also like a super rectangular room, and the width of the room is 2 meters, which is the size of a bed. So I'm thinking, yeah, I'm going to put my bed there at the back of the room, and then I'll have plenty of space for a desk and maybe a small table some bookshelves. And then it turned out that if you put the bed there, it's going to cover on both sides the electrical outlets, which is super inconvenient. So I had to give up on that. And then I started to rethink again. It's like, okay, this is a challenge. It's not a problem. It's a challenge. What if I turn this into a small office? Because, of course, my work will continue just as before. And even though most of Tridio is right now a work-from-home environment, it is still important to, at times, meet with the team and be able to have a place, for instance, for administration. There's a lot of paperwork that we have to conserve and archive somewhere. And, of course, I cannot ask Inga to keep that at her place because, well, she has her own apartment, and this is work-related stuff. So I figured, you know what? What if we take that smallest room and turn it into an office? And then all of a sudden, since there doesn't have to be a bed in that room, there is actually a lot of space for a desk, for some... I had some of those Billy bookcases, which are, you know, typical for an office. They're not very nice furniture for downstairs, for instance. So I have more classic furniture downstairs. So let's just put all that into that small room. It will have a printer. We have the kind of this closed cupboard where you can put a laser printer inside, and it's all. When I started to rethink the room like that, it just all of a sudden all came together. It's like, this is going to be perfect for a small office space. And then down the stairs, I've got the big living room, and I'm still kind of figuring out where to put the table. Oh, I got this old IKEA table, and I never really liked it. I bought it because you can extend it. You can make it bigger. There's a you can put some extra planks in the middle of it, so you can seat like 6 or 8 people around the table. But the table itself is a little bit, it's a very let's say if you sit behind it, you cannot cross your legs because the actual, the extra parts of the table are hidden in a compartment underneath the top of the table. So for that reason, it is a bit clunky, and I never really liked the table just for dinner. So I have another table that is better, but then again, the style is a little bit too modern and too office-like, so it doesn't really feel like something you want to put in a living room. However, I was looking at IKEA hacks. You know, there's an entire world of websites and YouTube channels dedicated to taking original IKEA furniture and then give it an enhanced purpose, or just add some stuff to make it work in situations for which it wasn't designed. And I saw that people were turned that particular type of table that I had into a board game table. So instead of putting the extensions underneath the table top, they emptied it. They closed the bottom of that container space, and then the cool idea is that you can put a board game inside the table. And if you are, and usually when you play these more intricate board games, you can't finish that in one day or in one evening. So it's always a hassle to have to kind of shelve or put everything back in a box, remember what you already did. And especially if the game is not made to be stored, then you can't, oftentimes you can't leave it on the table for a week. But this concept of a game table, you play the game and then you just close the tabletop over it and you use it as a dinner table. And the next week or the next month, when you want to continue the game, you just open the two sides of the table and you can just continue playing. I thought it was genius. It will take some carpenter skills, I think, to modify that table. But I think that there are some good descriptions on how to do that online, and I think I'm going to ask someone to help me do that, because that all of a sudden kind of totally redeems that table, and now I'm actually super happy that I have the table because it's no longer available at IKEA. So I'll keep you. That to me sounds like the perfect project to share with people on YouTube, for instance, or on social media. So I'm definitely going to work on that. So, will I be able to move in soon? It depends. It depends. I'm recording this on a Sunday, in a Sunday afternoon, or actually it's already Sunday evening. I skipped my run. I was supposed to run 32K today for the marathon training, but yesterday I carried all that IKEA stuff with Hank and some other people. So I was just tired. And yesterday I had to run 16K. I didn't sleep all that well. Or at least not enough. I had mass this morning, which also afterwards I spoke a lot of people. So I was just so tired. And I know that if I'm tired and I've been just doing too much physical work the day before, I should be careful not to get an injury. So instead, plus it's been raining the entire day. It was horrible weather. So I decided, you know what? I'm just going to run tomorrow morning. The weather will be better. I will have had a good night's sleep, and I know that I can juggle it around without too much impact on my overall training results. So that leaves me some time to record this. Later on in the show, I'll be talking some more about board games. Tomorrow, so on Monday, the guy who broke his collarbone, he will still come to the house, and he will have two other people that he will instruct to work on the kitchen, among other things. So hopefully they'll be able to finish some things at least. I don't know if the kitchen is ready. Oh, and there's one other reason that I couldn't move in, and that is that the warm water was not working. There's a boiler device in the attic, and I think they turned it off when they were redoing all the piping. And so they never turned it on. So there's no hot water. So I was like, okay, I think I can, I'm fine with just sleeping on the floor on a mattress, but I'm not fine with waking up and then not being able to take a shower or make a cup of coffee in the kitchen, because these two things are just physically impossible. So that's why I'm still here in the loft at the rectory, even though I can't wait to move into the new house. It's long overdue. Anyway, that's what's going on in my house, in my, well, not in my house, but in my life. Let's move over to the world of health.
Just look at the x-rays. You see that dark spot there? Whiplash.
Whiplash? Oh no.
And this smudge here that looks like my fingerprint? No, that's trauma.
So this morning, I was insulted because of the my looks. I'm not kidding you. I was celebrating Mass in Ede, which is a town very close by. And, well, was a very nice Mass. Afterwards, I spent some time just talking, getting to know the parishioners. For me, all these places are new, and a lot of people know me from TV, but I don't know them personally. So they may approach me, and they know a lot. And there were actually a few people that are following me on Instagram, and they knew everything about Arturo the cat. And it was such a mind warp, because I always like feel those have always been two different worlds. Like the parishioners, that was one world, and I would speak to them in a certain way, and it's the church world, and then my social media, the podcast, the YouTube, that's a different planet. That is people from all over the world, and there were rarely crossovers before, but this has changed since I moved here, because probably also because there are more students, there is more of an international community also in these various parts of the parish. And so two people came to see me like, oh, we know you from Instagram. We're huge fans. Can we take a picture for Instagram? I was like, okay. But anyway, so I spent quite a bit of time talking. And then some other people came in to prepare for a Mass in Vietnamese. There's a large Vietnamese community that gathers once a month to celebrate Mass with their Vietnamese priest. And so I was in the sacristy. And then the Vietnamese priest came in, and I had already seen him once, but never really got to talk to him. And the first thing he said is, oh, you look much worse than on television. I was like, what? He said, "You, what is wrong? Are you sick? You have lost too much weight. What's the reason for that? Are you working too hard?" I said, "No, I'm running too much." And then he started laughing, and he said, "You really changed." And it's true, because the shows that are currently on TV, we filmed them in the month of June and July. And that was before I started my training, my marathon training. And at the time, I weighed 84 kilos. And in the meantime, I've lost more than 12 kilos already. So that's, well, let's say 24 pounds. Between the Father Roderick that's currently on TV and the Father Roderick that lives now, there is a difference of 24 pounds. That's quite a bit. And so he was like, he was worried. It's like, dude. And then the other sacristan, or the sacristan, said to the priest, well, that's probably because you eat too much that you are worried. You just want to, you know, do like a preventive strike there. But actually, I was happy that at least people see the difference. And I do. I feel the difference, but more than I see it. Because, of course, when you start losing weight and living healthier, it's a gradual process. So at first, I didn't really notice any difference from day to day. But now that I look back to the footage of the TV shows, oh my goodness, I definitely have lost a lot of weight. And my overall physical condition, of course, has never been better. I've shared with you before that I think I'm in a better shape than I've ever been before running a marathon. Now, of course, still depends on the weather and on many other factors, whether that will result in a better finishing time. But I know that I have never ran this fast before, and I still feel that I'm not even at my peak. So I've always thought, you know, I will never be able to run at a speed that will qualify me for the Boston Marathon, for instance, because you have to be able to run a very fast marathon. And now I'm thinking, you know what? I actually think that with maybe another year of training, I could actually run a competitive marathon. Of course, I'm never going to be a competitive athlete, but at least I won't be among the slow people anymore. And the funny thing is, I never thought I would be able to do it. And it's just because I've been so consistent in the training, and I've been, I don't know, the training program that I follow, the Hal Higdon app, was so much better than the regular text schedules that I followed in the past. This one is tailor-made on my goals. Instead of just choosing a certain type, like normally I would go for intermediate or something like that, which is super generic. Here you had to say, I want to finish the marathon under this time, and then it would calculate how much you should run and how fast, and every day it pushes me a little bit beyond the comfort zone, but never too much. And so sometimes I get penalized because I run too fast. And it tells me, the app tells me, I told you to take it slow and you went overboard. And so I'm going to subtract some points. So it has a rating system to show you how you're doing. Next time, take it easy, because there's nothing worse than overtraining and getting injured. And then I kind of feel bad, but at the same time, I'm like, I'm so glad I have this app, because it has helped me so much more than any other training preparation that I've done in the years before. I wish I'd discovered this earlier. So, yeah, I don't mind looking a little bit skinnier, and I'm actually not even at my ideal weight. I'm still, right now, I'm around 72 kilos, whereas for my height and my build, around 66 would be good. So I've got about 6 kilos to go. That's almost nothing. You know, I'm losing almost a kilogram per week. So by the time I'm going to run the Marathon of Rotterdam, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I'd be almost at that weight. But I do know it does show. And there is a real visual difference between a Father Roderick that weighs 84 kilos or Father Roderick that weighs 66 kilos. And I also notice it because all my clothes are so loose now and my trousers are too big and I need to get some new clothes. So I'm so happy that we had this whole time of COVID where you couldn't go to the store to get new clothes. So everything I have here in terms of clothes, they're all used to the thread. How you say that? They're completely used up, and there are holes in my socks and everything. But now I know that if I go and buy new clothes, at least they will fit me for a while, because, you know, I'll be at my normal weight, and I intend to stay there. So, every disadvantage has its advantages, as a famous soccer players once said in the Netherlands. So that's what I wanted to share with you. Oh, one other thing. Now that I'm feeling so good, and I just benefit so much from regular sleep and healthy food, I start to notice even more when fellow priests or colleagues are not at that level. I'm not comparing, but I get more worried when I see how some of my fellow priests are actually just as unhealthy as I was a couple of years ago. And in my diocese, we sometimes talk about exploding priests, which is a very common phenomenon. That when you see the candidates to the priesthood in seminary, they're skinny, they're being fed, right? So there's always a cook in the seminary to make sure that they eat good food, but also healthy food, not too much. And then once they are ordained and they are living alone on a rectory, and they have all of a sudden so many responsibilities, often also in many parishes tensions, because, well, we're in a process of downscaling, closing churches. All that takes a huge toll, especially on younger, inexperienced priests. And what I've noticed time and again is compensation. And I've done that as well. When I was a young priest, I was very heavy. And it was just because after a rotten day, I would just soothe myself with food. I would just eat potato chips, just lots of junk food, just to feel good. And of course, it's the worst thing you can do, because then you're destroying yourself in the long run. So I empathize, but I'm also kind of conflicted. I don't want to pretend that now I'm better than they are, and I know where they're coming from, but I also know that in the long run, this can be so damaging to your overall health and also to your spiritual well-being. So I kind of have this urge to warn them, you know, please get some help, go to, you know, get a coach, or make sure you don't always try to compensate for stress in your life by overeating. Try to get rid of the stress. There's so much that I would like to teach the younger generation of priests. And then at the same time, I'm thinking, well, but what are they going to think if I do that? You know, they're going to probably be very irritated that I felt like that when I was at their age. I was like, I didn't want anyone else to tell me what to do and how to live my life. I felt like I'm finally free, you know? And at the same time, I was like, oh my goodness. You know, you guys, you're a generation of priests that are gonna have to carry the load of the church in this transition time, and it's so much more difficult and complex than it's ever been, even much more difficult than when I was a young priest. By all means, make sure you've got the physical health to pull through. Otherwise, you'll get a burnout, or like what sometimes happens with priests when they're super overweight or obese for several years, they develop all sorts of, you know, maybe heart problems or diabetes. And of course, sometimes you can still reverse that by changing your lifestyle. But why wait until you get those very serious health problems to change your life? Better be prepared and prevent that. And I've been thinking, you know, maybe it's also because it's something that we never talk about in seminary. We never ever talked about healthy food or how to deal with stress or how to organize your time, how to manage people. We were very skilled in theology and philosophy and human sciences and all that. But we have no idea how to live a healthy life. And it is thanks to good friends that sometimes have also coached me and helped me and given me good advice. Also, thanks to you, to my community, that has often expressed their worries when I was in a rut or not doing well, or helped me, pointed me to books that I should read, or YouTube videos or podcasts to listen to. And I took it in because I've had the experience early in my life as a priest of a burnout. And I know that that has been one of the most devastating times in my life. And it was very difficult to get out of that. And had I known what I know now, I don't think I would have ever fallen for that. But it's something that's still lurking out there, the dangers of work, of being overworked, burnout, the Messiah complex, thinking you have to save the church and you have to be, everybody has to like you, otherwise you feel bad about yourself, that kind of stuff. It took me 25 years of priesthood to discover that I was wrong in the beginning, and I had to learn so much after my ordination. I thought I was done studying, whereas I would say that maybe 90% of the things that I teach now in my homilies, for instance, I learned that in the past 5 years. It's insane. And it's by reading, it's by having good friends, having good coaches and advice. And it's so much that I wish the younger generation would learn, so that they don't fall in the same trap that I fell into. But at the same time, should I interfere with other people's lives? It's a conundrum. I don't know. If you have any advice, let me know on the Discord server. There's a section where we can talk and share our thoughts over, after listening to a podcast. Maybe we can we can start a conversation about that. Do you correct people? Do you warn them? How can you give feedback without interfering or pretending that you are better than the person that you're trying to correct? And what about, you can't just give advice if there's not a request for advice. You can't help someone if that person doesn't want to be helped. So how to act in that situation? And I think what I know I can do is give the right example and share how much this healthy lifestyle and getting enough sleep has changed my life, and also what I've learned about focusing on this is something I share over and over again on the walk, is how much focus has changed my life. Choosing to do the things that I need to do and that I'm good at or maybe excel at, to focus on that and to get rid or outsource everything that you can outsource and other people can do as well or better than you. That is the art of focusing and on it's kind of essentialism. It's akin to minimalism. Just be thankful and focus on the few things that truly make you happy, and all the rest that gives you stress, it probably doesn't belong in your life. So either acquire the skills to deal with it or get rid of it, and don't feel guilty about it, because that's the biggest issue that the many priests struggle with. It is, this misplaced sense of responsibility that if I don't do it, the world is going to crumble and the parish is going to perish. Of course not. The world will keep turning, even though you are not taking part of it. But your world will stop turning if you fall over and get seriously ill or are overwhelmed with stress. So give yourself permission to take good care of yourself. Another thing that I've learned in this past month of self-care, you can't take care of other people if you don't take good care of yourself as well. And I've repeated that almost on a daily basis to combat that inner voice that accuses me of being too selfish and being too self-centered. It's the voice also of other people in my life that told me that in the past. And it's not right. It is not true. Taking good care of yourself is part of your responsibility. So and working on good health, taking good care of your own health, will make you more available to other people. And if you fall ill, if you're overworked, if you're in a burnout, then you can help no one else. So yeah, that's what I want to share with you. Let's dive into the kitchen for a moment. Upheaval and stress and panic here at the rectory last week because students were coming over for dinner and one of them had told Father Henry that she was a vegan. And I think that Father Henry had to look it up because he was familiar with vegetarianism and he knew, but it was a repressed memory, that I had been vegan for about a year or so, actually a year and a half. And the only time that he had been confronted with the consequences of a vegan lifestyle was when we were going on vacation and all of a sudden I would not eat meat. And he could not understand it. Now, of course, I explained to him that back then it was just an experiment that I did for Lent. And I liked the challenge of cooking without meat, and it gave me so much more incentive to be creative in the kitchen. That's why I continued to live that vegan lifestyle. And it was during that vacation that he, according to him, had his greatest victory. And that was, I think we were in the Czech Republic it was somewhere else. I think it was, I don't know, it was one of those vacations in the eastern part of Europe, and I cooked my own food for about a week, lots of veggies, but then the rest of the group was eating just the regular food and enjoying it. And then we went to this one small village where they were famous for their truffles. So they had trained pigs, and they would find these truffles, and over there you could. There was one restaurant and they would just serve you everything with truffles and it, like fresh and would be com- completely unaffordable in the Netherlands. But over there, since there was so much, there were so, you know, this was such a common thing. We ordered a meal, and then I remember that we ordered pasta, and they had a vegan alternative, but the other plates were with beef. It was just a steak, and I remember that I was glad that there was also a vegetarian option, so I ordered pasta with legumes or something like that. And then the waiter came. Or actually, I think it was the cook. It was such a small restaurant that he was doing also the work of the waiter. And my three friends were sitting there with this nice creamy pasta and then a big chunk of meat, steak. And then the cook came with a real truffle, you know, just one, it's basically a type of mushroom. And he was grating it over their pasta. And the smell was divine. And I remember, and he didn't give any of that to me. I was just eating this bland pasta. Apparently, it's one of the, I think, misunderstandings of many cooks when they think they think that actually cooking vegan means also not using any herbs and not using spices and salt and pepper. And it was so bland and it tasted, and it was just the legumes, it was just basically bell peppers. Like cooked bell peppers. Who wants to eat that? Seriously. And I cracked. I was like, the cook was walking away. I said, can you please, would you have one of those plates for me? So, and I remember that for Father Henry, that was the biggest victory of that vacation. It's like, I've converted Father Roderick. He's back to eating meat. Now, another reason that I ultimately switched back to a flexitarian diet, so it means sometimes I don't eat meat. Like, what was it? Friday, I made a lasagna. I was super proud of that. And I didn't use meat. I used a meat replacement. It's basically, I don't think it's soy-based, but anything. Anyway, it's not very good if you just use it as meat. But if you use it, for instance, in a pasta, the structure kind of feels like meat, but doesn't have the same taste. But since the lasagna itself was full of herbs and all sorts of ingredients and a nice tomato sauce, all made with fresh ingredients, I served it to Father Henry and to, what's his name? Michele. Michele is another Italian former student, and he now is looking for, was actually doing an internship in Amsterdam, and so he lives at the rectory. Luigi was not there. And so, Michele comes back from his work in Amsterdam, and Father Henry's there, and Eric was gone. And so I serve the lasagna, and they both are like, oh, this is so good, and they're eating it. And at the end of the meal, I revealed, actually, this is, you know, it's Friday. You may think that you've just eaten a lasagna bolognese with meat in it, but this was actually completely vegan. And then silence. And then Michele is like, well, I really liked it. It was good. Father Henry was a little bit more shocked. He's like, oh, okay. I did not know that. He didn't even notice it. So that fills me with pride. I can still do it, even though I don't always eat vegan. So, but one of the reasons that I switch back to a mixed diet is that I got a vitamin B12 deficiency after a year and a half. So I ran a marathon being a vegan. That was for me very important proof of concept that, you know, you don't need to eat meat all day or every day to be healthy. In fact, you can run a marathon just on plant-based food. But after, from what I understand, B12 is something that your body cannot produce. You have to get it from other food, like for instance meat. It's also, it can also be plant-based, or you can take supplements. It turns out, well, what I think happened, I never had it verified by a doctor, but that you have a certain supply of vitamin B12, and as long as you have that, fine. And then all of a sudden it's depleted, and if you don't eat food that will replenish it, you will have very serious consequences of that. And in my case, I think what happened is all of a sudden I was so tired and I couldn't run anymore. I was sleeping all day long. I just felt like all of a sudden all the energy is gone. And at first I was like, maybe it's because I have too much stress. I work too hard. Nothing helped. And then I tell this to my parents, and my father said, hey, you may be suffering from what I have, in the sense that he had had a doctor's exam that showed that he was unable to get B12 from supplements. So his body had much more difficulty extracting the B12 vitamins or whatever. And apparently it's hereditary. And I think what happened is I probably have the same affliction as my dad. And eating meat is kind of part of the only ways for me to keep my B12 levels at a normal level. That I never went to the doctor, but I know that since my father told me that, I was like, okay, well, I can just switch back and see what that does. And the week after I started to eat meat again, my energy returned. And it was like awakening from a zombie state. I was like, this is what being normal feels like. And so I don't know. I don't think it is a placebo effect, but and I still have sometimes moments that I am tired, but that can have many different reasons. It can also be vitamin D deficiency. So I don't have a positive proof that that was the reason, but it was very, very striking to me that when I started to eat meat again, or mixing in meat from time to time in my diet, my energy returned. So now I'm just trying to balance it out as much as possible. And I still believe that it is very important for the world to go just beyond always taking meat for granted. And when I was talking to a urologist a number of years ago, because I had these recurring kidney stone problems, he said, you know, one of the things you could do is change your diet and eat more plant-based food. We advise people to not eat more than about 100 grams of meat or 150 grams at max. What was it? 3 times a week. That's all you need, he said. All the rest is just extra. And in your case, since your kidney stones have a certain chemical, indicate a certain chemical imbalance, I'd recommend you don't eat more than 3 times a week some meat. And then just small portions is enough. You don't have to eat an entire steak then. I always remembered that. And it's just now I just wing it, you know. It's just sometimes I'm wondering, well, why would I not cook vegetarian and sometimes even vegan? You know, you can have a very delicious meal and not miss the meat at all. I kind of stepped away from the meat replacements. So I think in my country now, McDonald's has launched a McVeggie or something like that. No, the McPlant, which is, the fake hamburger meat that is very popular in the U.S. They've imported it in the Netherlands. But I'm like, well, why? I can eat so many other things, and a burger doesn't have to taste like meat for me. I can just eat something else. So anyway, what I was trying to say is it is important, I think, that as a global community, we'll learn that we don't need to rely on meat consumption as much as we do right now. It's better for our health, but it's also better for the world and for the overall balance of creation. And I was reading article about South Korea now considering abolishing the practice of eating dog meat. And I was like, oh my gosh, I forgot that they eat golden retrievers sometimes. Well, I'm just using the word. I don't know if they're golden retrievers, but I just can't imagine that someone would voluntarily eat meat that comes from a dog unless you maybe are a zombie or otherwise starving. But no. And then the article actually made the point that, you know what, people that love dogs, they will, you know, just as easily eat, just meat from a pig, whereas a pig is, we know this, is just as intelligent, if not more intelligent, as a dog. They're just not as cuddly, But why do we, what's the difference between a pig and a dog? That's just in our mind that it's different. But, and this is because we've become disconnected with the origin of our meat. We get it from the supermarket, and we look at it as just materials. It's stuff. It's something. And we don't really want to think too much about where it comes from. It made me think. It was like, yeah, actually, if someone would tell me, hey, would you like some ground dog over your pasta or in your pasta sauce, I'd probably say no, thank you, and I'd run away as fast as I could. So there's a lot to think about when it comes to which animals do we think is actually is morally good to eat and whatnot. It's culturally, it's in our head, it's in our minds, and it differs from culture to culture. So even I already noticed the difference between the US and Europe. When I went to the US, everything is beef. Like, it's like red meat everywhere, every meal, so much beef. Whereas here in the Netherlands, we eat beef, but we also eat pork and more just chicken. Also, the kind of the meat replacements and the vegetarian market is growing exponentially every year. So there is a huge shift going on right now in Europe, which I actually like. I kind of like that awareness. Think about what you eat and why you eat it, and if there are alternatives that may be better for you and be better for the animals as well. I don't know. However, now that I've been talking about food, I'm getting hungry. And I still have half of a chicken that I need to somehow integrate in one of my meals. So I don't think I'm going to eat a vegetarian meal tonight. I apologize in advance to all the chickens. This is the segment where I share with you what I've learned. Now, I told you that I was learning Latin with the aid of an app called ASCII something. Anyway, and I was the other day, I was talking with Luigi about languages, and Luigi, originally from Italy, but he's got a knack for languages. He taught himself Dutch, which is a hard language to master. Within a year, he was able to hold a regular conversation, and he taught himself just by reading books and by watching Dutch TV. Unbelievable. I don't think he ever opened a grammar book. And then every time he meets people from another country, he wants to learn that language. And now he works in Amsterdam. And he told me last Friday, I think, that he was going to have a lesson in, was it Portuguese? I think it was Portuguese. I was like, what, do you mean you go see a teacher? And I said, no, there's this this app that I use. And you can just, there are thousands of people that are ready to give you one-on-one language courses. And the app is kind of an intermediate. And it's very affordable. It's much cheaper than if you would hire a regular teacher, you know, in the town where you live. And I'm trying to find the app here. I'm not sure I installed it on my iPad. What was it again? It had a name. Oh, wait a minute. I got an email from that service. And I'm a little bit intimidated by it because you type in, you know, what's the language you want to learn? And then it will give you a list of available teachers. And they can be anywhere in the world. And they either teach you through a one-on-one session through the app, or via Skype, no matter, it depends on what you want. So I like that. It's called iTalki. So it's iTalki, iTalki. And at first when he was talking about it, I misunderstood. I thought the app was called iTalkien. I was like, wow, so there is an app for lessons about Tolkien? How cool is that? And he's like, no, it's iTalki. Okay, so it's a language app. Okay, I'm a little bit disappointed, but still cool. What is intimidating to me is that it is one-on-one. That's kind of one of the reasons that I never got into, what's that app again? Clubhouse. You know, there is something intimidating. For someone who's introverted like me, knowing that you are in a group of people and you are there, you're kind of visible, you can't lurk in the background. That's also why I don't like to watch live streams, where the moment you hop onto the live stream, your tag, your name will appear in the feed of the one who is streaming, because they may call you out, they may call your name, and then I'm like, I thought I was invisible, and now people are actually, oh, let alone having a one-on-one language course. I'm not sure if I'm ready for that, but the idea of being able to, and anyone can also teach language courses. You can leave reviews, so it's a little bit like Yelp. So the good teachers, the ones that are really good, they get all high marks, and of course that will generate even more clients. I think it's a genius app and idea to because of course the best way to learn a language is just to speak it with someone who's a native speaker. That's how I kind of mastered English and French. It's not through reading grammar books, it's just by practicing, just by speaking the language, even though in the beginning it's hard, and then over time it gets gradually easier. So now I'm kind of tempted to see if I can do a combination of maybe learning a language through Lingo? What's the bloody app called? Lingo? Oh, man. You probably already yelled it to your iPod, but I'm an old man. Duolingo. Okay, the reason I was confused is that there was also a TV show. It's called Lingo in Dutch. Duolingo. And then maybe from time to time get these one-on-one courses with someone, and especially for the pronunciation. That is important to really hear and listen to how it is properly pronounced, and also to learn the slang, learn the little things that you don't find in the grammar and books or in the vocabulary dictionary or the vocabulary list. What is the language I would like to learn? Gosh, I want to definitely continue to learn Spanish because I love that language. Maybe some Chinese. It still intrigues me. Or Japanese. Although if I learn Japanese, my Chinese family is going to be outraged, because there seems to be a bit of a rift between Japan and China, and maybe vice versa. But I would like to learn at least one language that is exotic to me, that it's not related to any other language that I speak, just because I like to master a language that is completely foreign to me. Even Spanish feels a little bit like tricking myself, because I already know how to speak French and Italian, and Spanish, of course, coming from the same Latin source, has so much in common with those languages that it almost feels like I'm not really learning a language. Oh, well, I'll keep you up to speed.
I'm quite keen on comic books, especially the ones about superheroes. I find the whole mythology surrounding superheroes fascinating.
You ever try these comics?
No.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
I saw two trailers at the movies of two upcoming superhero movies. One was Venom 2. Now, if you remember, I was never a fan of the first Venom movie. I watched it maybe online. I don't even remember. Or did I go to the movies? I didn't get it. It was just not for me. No. I liked Venom. The appearance of Venom in the third Spider-Man movie by Samuel Raimi. But I never really... I thought it was too weird and a bit vulgar, a bit brutal. I know Venom has a lot of fans, but I just couldn't get into it. I don't know what it is. Now, there was this trailer for Venom 2. I was like, yep. I still don't like it. I still really don't care for the whole franchise. And it just looked like even more gore and more craziness. Nah, I don't think I'm gonna skip that one. Although I do have a subscription to my local theater. So in fact, I wouldn't have to pay extra to see it. Maybe I'll go see it, but I don't have, the trailer didn't give me much hope that I would be converted into a Venom fan. And then there was another trailer for a movie that I kind of passed under my radar. It's called The Eternals. I was like, I don't know. Maybe that's interesting. Maybe that could work. But I'm not familiar at all with that group. It's just another ensemble movie. I was like, well, I'd rather watch the X-Men. Just bring X-Men into the MCU. And yeah, I'm a huge fan of the X-Men. I've always been a massive fan of the X-Men as an ensemble story. And I was saddened to see how much every subsequent X-Men movie kind of went down in quality. But I still enjoy watching their history. I don't know about the Eternals. I guess I'll just have to go and see it. Anyway, something else that's upcoming on Disney Plus, and I'm super excited about, is The Book of Boba Fett, which was announced, of course, at the end of the second season of The Mandalorian, with the appearance of the original Boba Fett. Well, not the original Boba Fett from the first three movies, but the Boba Fett from the prequels. And we now have a film poster, or series poster, and it looks cool. And there's a second poster that hints at the appearance of a character that we so far have only seen, I think, in The Clone Wars, and maybe Star Wars Rebels, but I haven't finished that series yet. So that is pretty exciting as well, that they're going to translate even more animated characters to real-life TV. And it's Star Wars. It's fresh Star Wars stories, and this is about Boba Fett. What's not to like? I hope it's going to be amazing, and I can't wait to see it. I'm so happy that we're going to have at least some more Star Wars towards the end of the year. In December, I'm so looking forward to winter because of that. Finally, I'll have my own television and I'll be able to watch new Star Wars stories and do lots of YouTube videos about Star Wars. Oh man, it's gonna be awesome. For someone who has turned talking into basically his mission by podcasting since the year 2005, the recent remarks of Pope Francis that a homily should not last longer than 7 or 8 minutes because otherwise you're just torturing people, were hard to follow. This is something that he's been saying for years. And I always thought at the beginning it's just a joke, you know, it's just his humor. That you should just keep your homily short. He actually does give the example himself. He's usually, his homilies are short, to the point, and at other times he will talk for an hour. It just depends on the situation, but I started to understand more and more that, no, this is actually a problem in many cases where homilies are so boring and so uninspired that even 7 or 8 minutes is probably already a lot. And of course, in a situation like that, yes, then make it short, because the Catholic liturgy is about much more than just a homily. I know that in certain Protestant traditions, the preaching is the centerpiece. You know, that's the most important ingredient, that and singing. In Catholic liturgy, it's always been just part of the entire communication that God engages in when we go to church. It's the Word of God, Jesus, but it's also Jesus coming to us, not just in the Word, but also in the sacrament of the Eucharist. And so I always felt that there was a very broad, also a certain variety in the Catholic liturgy that makes it, I think, also strong and attractive. And it's not always verbal or intellectual. Catholic liturgy, if you celebrate it in a good way, will communicate with all your senses. Will be, I don't know, will engage the entire person, not just the brains. And so in that respect, I do agree that the homily should never be too overbearing. However, I'm one of the worst offenders. I don't recall the last time that I had a homily under 7 minutes or under 8 minutes. My homilies usually run 15 to 20 minutes and sometimes even longer, to be perfectly honest. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a model in that respect, that people should emulate this, and I'm definitely don't want to just skip the advice of Pope Francis. However, I do believe, also, and this is based on feedback that I get, that people don't mind if a homily takes 15 minutes or 20 minutes, as long as they're engaged for all those minutes. And that is something that I feel that, and I'm grateful for, that it's what I've learned how to do by doing these shows, by doing podcasts and having all these, like, for instance, the podcast that you just listened to consists of all these different moments. And there's an audio cue, there's a jingle. But if you noticed, I'm also telling stories. For instance, when I was talking about the evening with this vegan student, and then Father Henry being so up in arms, like, well, what do I do? What do I serve? I don't know how to cook vegan. And then I told the story about the restaurant in Eastern Europe. I'm pretty sure that you could picture the scene, right? So that is what I always try to do, to make it as visual as possible. When I was talking about Venom, you probably had images if you've seen the trailer. You kind of picture that, and that helps you to stay attentive. I do the same thing in the homilies. Like this morning, I had a quite long homily, and I was explaining creation theology, and that for, you know, there is a, right from the get-go, a relationship between creation and the animals and the first man that God creates, and then the God makes the animals so they can be a companion for the first man that he created, and then he still knows that it's not enough. He needs someone who is like him to love, and that is, you know, that's going to be the whole blueprint of creation, is this relational aspect of it. And there are degrees in that relationship. Now, I illustrated that with stories about, for instance, Arturo, the cat. And everybody knows Arturo because I post photos of him every once in a while on Instagram, and it's kind of become this meme in the parish, like, oh, like every homily, the rectory cat is coming along as an example. But it helps. It's just a visual cue. And people afterwards, they tell me, oh, that was a nice homily, especially the part about the cat. And I was like, well, that was just an example. But I'm glad that at least you were still awake. And so I think that what Pope Francis wants to tell us is that it's you stay to the point. You don't want people to fall asleep because the homilies are unnecessarily long. And then giving us a time frame of 8 minutes requires you to go to keep to the point, to focus, and to leave out what is not necessary. You can't overstuff people with words. I would add to that, yes, that, but also talk in a visual way, paint pictures, tell stories. Narrative preaching is the best way to prevent boredom, and it's also what people will remember. It's one on it's what is it 101 for TED Talks. Tell a story. You will notice if you go to the TED website or you watch the TED channel on YouTube, every speaker has these anecdotes that they tell. And what do you remember? You remember the story that they told and maybe one or two conclusions. All the rest, you forget about it. And that's not a problem. That's just how we perceive and that's how we remember things. Stories are the most powerful way of communicating values. Instead of being too abstract, theological, philosophical, intellectual, tell stories. The story will carry your values, will carry your message much better than just intellectual verbiage. So, yeah, I do agree with Pope Francis. We need to take better care of the quality of our homilies. I don't think that you manage to do that just by reducing the time that priests can preach. I would say start with teaching priests to tell stories, to to be creative to inject some humor or cats into the homily. That, I think, is much more important than just preaching for 8 minutes.
The humanoid must not escape.
So, as I mentioned at the start of this podcast, I have started to play a board games with Eric here, who's going to be ordained a deacon later this year and a priest next year, God willing. And he introduced me to a board game that I knew from my friend Sebastian, who introduced me to the wonderful world of board games years and years ago. And he had this one board game called Time Stories, and it's actually T-I-M-E Stories. It's an acronym for something that I forgot. And I loved it. The description, so what I thought was so interesting about this board game is that you, when you buy the board game, you just get the game mechanics. You get tokens, you get a board itself, you get some basic rules, but then you have this one story that uses the game mechanics to tell a particular story. But then you can buy expansions, and they will use the same game mechanics to tell a totally different story in a totally different world. And it's that, I had never seen a game do that. And I love that concept. And so, but we never got around playing it. We played tons of other games, never that game. And I regret it. It's like, I'm so curious to see how that works. And then, when I discovered that Eric was a board game fan, he said, well, let's play a board game. And it turns out he had the Time Stories game. And it was so much fun. We started to play a game that was based on a pirate story. And even though we've only played for 2 hours and then we kind of had to shelve it for another day, I had so much fun. And the cards, you use certain cards, but they are also, the artwork is beautiful. We were in the world of Monkey Island all of a sudden. Well, not literally Monkey Island, but that same vibe, you know. And you can choose where to go. So we first went to the local bar near the harbor, and then we got into a fight with a captain there. We almost got killed. Then we took a tiny little flaky boat to an island where, and they had told us that we had a map. We bought a map that would indicate that on the island there was a place where you could buy rum. And then with rum, if you take it back home to the harbor, you can sell it, and with that money we could get a better boat. However, we'd never been, of course, to that island, and so you can choose. It shows you literally a few cards. If you put them together, it creates like a panorama of that island. And then it says there's a road that goes to the west, one that goes to a big tree, and one that goes to the right. So it feels a little bit like a board game version of the old adventure, the text adventures that I played as a child. And so you just have to, you don't know what's going to happen. So we turn to the left, and then we end up in quicksand, and there's this huge red snake that bites us and kills us, and so it's the end. And then we have to, the game begins again, and then, of course, you have a little bit more knowledge. The thing is, we ultimately ended up getting a lot of rum, getting on board of our tiny little ship that, and we were praying that we wouldn't encounter any pirates. We brought it back to the harbor, sold it for a huge price, and then we bought the best ship available. You know, while I'm telling you this, you may picture that Pirates of the Caribbean type of story. That's how it felt to, and it was just a board game doing that. But the same game mechanic can also plunge you into a world of mystery, or a Lovecraftian world, or a science fiction story. And it uses the same tokens, but every token, you know, in one game, the brown tokens are barrels of rum, and in another game, they are, I don't know, crazy monkeys that have been infected with a zombie virus. I love how they figured out how to create so many different stories based on the same storytelling game mechanic. I'm super excited. I can't wait to play the story, the full story. And unfortunately, Eric has already played all the other expansions. I haven't, so maybe I'll see if he can borrow me that game and I can play it with some friends in the new house using my IKEA modified game table. I can't wait. And with that, my friends, we've come to the end of this episode of Father Roderick to the Max. Well, this is more than max. This was an ultra max episode, 1 hour and 15 minutes. Again, as a thank you for your ongoing support for my mission, for my work, and most importantly, for your feedback and your friendship that I experience every day almost in the Discord server and through your feedback on social media. Thank you so much for being part of the community, and I'll talk to you next week. Take care, and God bless.